Welcome to the Diplomats Podcast on Asian Geopolitics. I'm your host, Ankit Panda, straight from New York. And first of all, welcome to 2015. This is going to be a great year. And we've actually made a few changes here at the Diplomat. We have some new editors on board that I'm very excited to introduce today. We have with me today on the podcast, obviously, we have Shannon Tiezi, whom you all know, who's our China editor. She's been on the podcast several times with us before. And our new editors are Franz-Stefan Gadi and Prashant Parameswaran. And I'll ask them both to just briefly introduce themselves before we get into the podcast. And what we're going to devote this podcast to, this is going to be a slightly longer episode than the previous ones that we've done. We're going to talk about, pretty much we're going to run the entire geography of Asia through and just talk about the geopolitical trends and expectations that we have for 2015. And, you know, some of the stories that we'll be looking to cover in more detail as the year progresses. So first, Prashant, can I invite you to just kind of tell us, you know, where you're coming to the Diplomat from and your background very briefly?
Sure, Ankit. So my name is Prashant Parameswaran, and I'm basically coming in from doing a lot of the Southeast Asia and some of the Asia security stuff at the Diplomat. So I used to work at a couple of think tanks, primarily the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, D.C., and then also the Project 2049 Institute. My background's mostly in Southeast Asia. I was born in Malaysia, lived in several countries there, and then have conducted a lot of research and done a lot of travel in Southeast Asia. So that's sort of my primary area of expertise.
Thanks a lot. And yeah, Prashant isn't a newcomer to the Diplomat. He was writing for us regularly on Southeast Asian issues. And you might have seen his blog at The Asianist, and he also tweets at The Asianist if you want to follow him on Twitter. I've been following him for a while, actually. And Franz, over to you.
Well, thank you very much. Well, I've been a senior fellow with the East-West Institute for the past 5 years, focusing on cybersecurity, regional security in South Asia, and a couple of other issues, such as civil-military relations in Europe and the United States. And I've also done my fair amount of reporting from Afghanistan, Iraq. So I'm fairly familiar with those places, and I'm very happy to be part of the team now.
Great, and we're obviously very excited to have you. You know, I was kind of thinking about how to organize this podcast because Asia, as you might know, is a large place with a lot of people. So it's very difficult to talk about Asia as a cohesive entity. So what I was thinking we would do is, because I feel like, you know, each of us, we kind of have our varying geographical areas of focus. So I thought we'd maybe start in Northeast Asia and just kind of logically work our way down the Asian rimland, going south and eventually to the west and maybe ending up with a discussion around Iran and Central Asia. So let's start with Northeast Asia, which is obviously a very hot region, home to two of Asia's most successful economies, South Korea and Japan, but also home to a major pariah state, North Korea. And obviously, you know, we're going to have a separate discussion about China, but I do want to include China in the Northeast Asian discussion because obviously, as we've seen last year, particularly with the rise of Shinzo Abe in Japan, historical issues involving these three countries have come to the fore that have led to, I won't say, you know, a frozen state of international relations, but a very, you know, relations are cold in Northeast Asia in general. We have the dispute over the Senkaku Diaoyu Islands that really flared up in 2012 and remained hot over 2013 and 2014, and also disputes between South Korea and Japan, and obviously the perennial looming threat of North Korea. So let's just briefly, you know, talk about Japan, which is, you know, always been a major player in Asian affairs. And going to 2015, we recently had Shinzo Abe and the LDP win a snap election in December, which put them on particularly strong political footing going forward into this year. But this obviously came on the heels of a terrible economic news for Japan, Abenomics, essentially, which brought Japanese consumption higher and brought up expectations of economic growth, essentially turned out to be a bit of a dud, and inflation projections were higher, and that's essentially, you know, kind of threw Japan back on the back burner. So, you know, let's just talk briefly about, you know, your major expectations for Japan. How do you see Shinzo Abe taking Japan forward, you know, over this next year? And this is obviously open for any one of you. I know none of you are really focused primarily on Japan, but obviously, you know, we all do think about Japan quite a bit.
Well, I talked with Dr. Sheila Smith from CFR. I did a video interview with her right after the Japan elections, and I would encourage our viewers to check that out because she's obviously far more knowledgeable about this than I am. But she basically pointed out that, yes, Shinzo Abe and the LDP won the elections, but that's really the beginning of a new path for them, and it's going to be a very difficult uphill climb. You know, Abe kind of had a more or less a mandate to try and keep doing what he's doing. But that really means that if he's not able to turn Japan's economy around, if Abenomics doesn't end up working, then that's probably going to be it for him. And there's a lot of structural issues with the Japanese economy, and the things that it's going to be very difficult politically for him to change, such as, you know, getting Japan into the TPP, dealing with some of the agricultural reforms that would require. It's going to be a very uphill road for him. So I think 2015 is going to really be a turning point for the Shinzo Abe administration. That doesn't mean that they might get voted out of office in 2015, but the seeds might be set for a resurgence of some of the opposition parties if the LDP continues to struggle.
And obviously, you know, on foreign policy, Abe is obviously a very interesting figure. I think, you know, one of the major lessons that he learned from his first term as prime minister back in 2006 was that, you know, the Japanese public was less receptive to the nationalist brand of politics that Abe wanted to bring to the forefront. And really what they wanted was an economically resurgent Japan. And obviously he focused on that during his second term with Abenomics. And I think you're right. I think, you know, we're going to see more of a focus on the TPP and more of a focus on restoring Japan's economy than on the nationalism, the constitutional reformation, all that stuff that the LDP has been very interested in, because that's essentially, you know, what Abe has to do this year to make go ahead.
Sorry, if I can just jump in here, I think it's also worthwhile pointing out that during the elections back in December 2014, the junior partner of the LTP, the Kometo Party, won four additional seats. And I've read some people arguing that this is sort of like a quiet power shift towards more of the liberal center and away from national right-wing forces within Japan. I'm not sure that I agree with that 100%. Because, for example, the appointment of Gen Nakatani as defense minister, I mean, he's a lawmaker who he was in favor of preemptive strikes, if I remember correctly, is, I think, a strong signal that the LTP will not easily give up on its goal to rid Japan of its free rider image in matters of international and national security.
Right, yeah. I wrote a piece about, you know, the road ahead for the LDP if it actually does want to push ahead with its constitutional reformation proposals. And, you know, I see it as very unlikely, even though I think it's been a bit overstated just how strong the LDP actually is after these December snap elections. Yes, you know, Shinzo Abe will likely be the longest serving Japanese prime minister since Koizumi in the early 2000s, but it seems highly unlikely that, you know, the LDP will be able to realize what it would, you know, what it's more a more conservative elements would want for Japan's constitution. And you're right, Franz, that's partly due to the Kometo Party, which is obviously against constitutional reformation as the LDP's partners in parliament.
Yes, I mean, I think that there will be perhaps an incremental change because, for example, I recently wrote a piece on a new law that the government is planning in order to speed up the deployment of Japanese self-defense forces abroad, which would not require a constitutional amendment. So I think we'll see tiny, tiny changes over the year in that field, and perhaps which perhaps will move Japan more and more towards a quote-unquote normal country when it comes to matters of international security.
Yeah. What are your thoughts, if I might ask you, on a U.S.-Japan defense guideline revision, which has been delayed? We were expecting those at the end of 2014, but it looks like it's going to take a little bit longer. But it seems like, you know, the U.S.-Japan relationship is being slightly redefined to give Japan a more active role, what Abe calls proactive pacifism, having Japan play a greater role in that alliance. What are your expectations there?
Well, I think not that much is going to change over the next 12 months, in my opinion.
I agree with that, yeah.
Yes, I think it will principally remain the same as it has in the last couple of years. I think a lot of the stuff was a bit overblown, and if you carefully read what's in the new defense guidelines. I don't think it's as revolutionary as some commentators make it to be.
All right, let's move over to the Korean Peninsula, where, you know, obviously North Korea ended 2014, obviously, on a huge note, being the news after the United States government accused it for perpetrating the Sony Pictures hack. And, you know, Franz, you're obviously our cybersecurity expert here on the panel. So, you know, what is this is obviously a huge topic. We could have a whole podcast or two on this. But, you know, what is your whole read of the effect of, you know, the backlash against North Korea from the United States? You know, what is this going to be a long-term issue? Is North Korea going to be a serious cyber threat? Is this an asymmetrical threat that the United States should take seriously in the long term? Or has this entire Sony Pictures incident been overblown?
Well, I'm always very hesitant to comment upon matters of cybersecurity prematurely, because I just don't think we really get the entire picture. Just because we do not have access to classified information, a lot of that stuff just happens behind, you know, closed doors and in the shadowy world of intelligence. So it's very tricky to really figure out who did it and who you know, and what the reasons are behind it. What's really interesting, in my opinion, is that we can perhaps assume that the United States has exploited the situation somewhat. In a sense that it, I think it is switching from a more conciliatory stance from the last couple of months to a more confrontational posture. I think that, for example, especially with the relationship of the United States to China, which I think the United States, in cyberspace at least, sees as the principal antagonist in Asia. The Pentagon has particularly tried to build trust between the Chinese and U.S. militaries with, for example, an unprecedented briefing of senior Chinese military leaders on the U.S. military doctrine for defending against cyber attacks a couple of months back. Also, the Obama White House quickly followed up and announced that it will share more openly intelligence on zero-day vulnerabilities, which is sort of a symbolic gesture of unilateral cyber disarmament. And I think both cases were meant to signal China that the United States, which is aware of its technological superiority, is willing to accommodate Chinese fears and more actively engage in dialogue. But so far, the Chinese response has been completely mute. The Chinese have not reciprocated any of these new initiatives. So I think, you know, in combination with the Sony hack, this, you know, could be exploited by the United States to show the United States to show China that there is a red line actually that China should not cross in cyberspace in 2015.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we saw a bit of that last year, too, with the Department of Justice indictment of the five, I think, PLA officers. That was a big story back then, which kind of, again, highlighted the cyber differences between the U.S. and China.
Yes, I think this is just part of an overall, what I would call an overall cyber deterrence strategy of the United States. You know, the indictments of the five hackers and now accusing North Korea, although the evidence appears to be somewhat flimsy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually very interesting, because you have all these independent security experts like, you know, Bruce Schneier, who's a very respected security analyst, saying that he doesn't buy the FBI's accusation. But then, you know, that makes me wonder why the United States would, with such a high degree of certainty, if, you know, if it actually has the evidence, you know, make this accusation against North Korea. I think that there is more to the story, and you're right. I think we should be prudent about speculating before we have all the information. So just to move the conversation forward here, Shannon, this is a question, you know, primarily for you, I guess, as our resident China expert. You know, as of the end of 2014, what's your read on the relationship between China and North Korea?
That's actually a very interesting question, and I'm going to cheat a bit and use an event that happened. It happened very late in 2014. The North Korean supposedly army deserter who crossed the China-North Korea border and murdered four Chinese citizens as part of a string of robberies. That supposedly happened on December 28th, but the Chinese government kept it entirely under wraps until South Korean media started reporting on it in early January. And then after that happened, the Chinese government announced that it had lodged an official protest at the North Korean embassy, and the Chinese media started reporting on it. So it was a very interesting sequence of events that I think speaks to the ambivalence that China has toward North Korea right now. There's been a lot of talk that China's rethinking its North Korea policy, but still its initial reaction to an event that is, you know, highly sensitive, potentially highly inflammatory of domestic opinion against North Korea was to hush it up, was we're not going to talk about this, we're not going to deal with this. And Xie Tao, who's one of our new China Power contributors, and I would encourage everyone to check out his article, he just wrote a piece, you know, positing what if this was a Japanese soldier who had done this, and you can imagine how different the Chinese reaction would have been. So there's still this very strong instinct in China to more or less protect North Korea, to try and insulate the relationship from any major changes. But then once the information was broken, the Chinese government doesn't want to be seen as doing that. They don't want to be seen as playing the role of North Korea's buddy, North Korea's protector. Then they immediately did an about face and said, you know, no, we have lodged an official protest. We're confirming that this did happen and this is an issue between our two countries. And even though we're handling it, we're taking care of it. So there, you know, I don't think we're going to see any sort of major policy change toward North Korea, just because the government in Beijing feels like they're more or less trapped into trying to keep the regime in Pyongyang alive for various geopolitical reasons. But at the same time, I don't think they enjoy being in that position. And if there were some magic solution where they could wish them away and not have to deal with any of the consequences of a united Korea that's also a U.S. ally or a humanitarian disaster along their border, they would probably do that.
Mm-hmm. It does seem to me like North Korea has been in the driver's seat over 2014. It's, you know, China's largely been reacting to what they've been doing and trying to keep this relationship moving along, at least. What are your, I guess this is a question for everybody. I mean, just, you know, do you think that this is the year that North Korea finally makes its big move towards Russia? Because obviously, you know, Russia's position in the international community has changed drastically over this year, and that opens up new avenues for it with North Korea. So is that a possibility that we should be watching this year?
I think so. I believe that Kim Jong-un has been officially invited to visit Russia in 2015 to celebrate the end of World War II. So that would obviously be huge. And Kim Jong-un has not been invited to visit China, so it would be fairly major geopolitical signaling if he is to visit Russia before he visits China, just as Xi Jinping visited South Korea and still has not paid a visit to the North. So there's definitely some tension going on there.
I'm actually glad you brought that up, because that was actually one issue that I wanted to discuss before we moved away from Northeast Asia to China, which is the you know, the fact that this year is the 70th anniversary of the end of the Second World War, which is obviously going to lead to commemorative events across the world, across Asia. And you know, whenever there's commemorations in Asia regarding the war, you'll bet that, you know, somebody's going to take a misstep, somebody's going to say something that's going to lead to, you know, a broader conversation about history. And obviously in Northeast Asia, this has been a huge problem. Historical wounds are still very fresh for South Korea and China based off of, you know, Japan's actions during the war. What is your expectation here? I mean, do you think that we'll see Japanese politicians again, you know, visiting Yasukuni Shrine, making inflammatory statements, repudiating the Murayama or Kono statements? You know, my expectations, I wrote about this again. I think this was one of the first pieces I wrote this year was, you know, I'm not too optimistic, but given the progress that was made towards the end of 2014 with the slight thaw in relations, you know, with that awkward handshake at APEC and everything, it seems like there are, you know, the stakes for Japan are slightly higher this year. And given the focus on economic issues, I think that Abe would be unwise, or at least the LDP would be unwise, to really make this more of an issue than it has to be. But I'd be curious to, you know, hear your opinions on it.
I'm inclined to think that everyone's going to be very careful about this. As you said, Ankit, we're kind of in the beginning, early stages of a thaw between China and Japan. And I think both sides are hyper-conscious that this anniversary year has a lot of symbolic meaning. So China has been a bit more cautious than I would have expected about how it is approaching Japan and the wartime history. It's Nanjing ceremonies. They had the first ever National Remembrance Day in Nanjing for the Nanjing Massacre this year in December, which was after the handshake scene around the world between Xi Jinping and Shinzo Abe. And that was, it still had the tones of Japan must apologize, Japan must not upset the post-World War II order, but it was a bit more conciliatory, I think, than a lot of people were expecting. You had Xi Jinping trying to draw this distinction between a tiny minority of hyper-nationalists in Japan and Japan as a whole, which is fairly new. So I think China, at least right now, is being a little bit more careful in how it talks about this, a little bit less inflammatory. And I would expect Japan to do the same. Again, there's a lot riding on this year versions of Abe domestically, and it's going to be difficult for him to move forward if there's another huge crisis between China and Japan, which will, inevitably impact the Japanese economy.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, I agree with that assessment generally. I think this is going to be, it's been very interesting. So, I'm looking forward to, hearing Abe's remarks, for example, when he goes to these commemorative events around the world. It'll be very interesting to see how he chooses his words. One of the earliest statements he made this year was that Japan will express his remorse, but what does remorse mean? Is he going to apologize for the Imperial Japanese Army's brutality during the war? All of these questions, I think, will be worth watching as the year goes on.
If I could just add one more thing, because you're talking about history and a thing, it is, of course, fairly important for both the Japan-U.S. relationship as well as the Japan-China relationship. And if there's one thing that I would like to see in 2015, then it perhaps it's that no more reference about the Anglo-German historical analogy and applying this to the Japan and China relationship. This is something that I think has been tremendously overused. And I think Shinzo Abe did it back in February at the World Economic Forum back in 2014, where he compared the relationship between Japan and China to the one of Great Britain and Germany prior to the First World War, with obvious implications. Mm-hmm. And I think, he referred to the Anglo-German arms race just to warn of a new arms race in Asia. But I think it's just to use those historical analogies fairly limits also our policy options today. And so I think I would like to see less of that.
Yeah, me too. You're absolutely right. I think last year we had, I would estimate, 20 to 30 pieces in The Diplomat arguing about the merits of that analogy. It was the 100th anniversary of 1914, so it did make sense that people would be thinking about that. But I agree that it definitely got overused. Anyways, if you guys don't mind, let's move the conversation over to China. Obviously, perennial topic of discussion, huge interest in China, obviously for good reasons. I actually want to start this discussion with a conversation about China's position on its territorial disputes in the East and South China Sea, mostly to bring Prashant into the conversation. He's been silently lurking in the background, and I'm very eager to hear his thoughts on this issue because he's been writing about this recently. So obviously China had a huge year in the East and South China Sea. Obviously it ended 2013 with the declaration of an air defense identification zone, which was a huge issue. And then last year, majorly, we had the dispute between China and Vietnam over the Chinese oil rig, and a variety of incidents in the South China Sea, the USS Cowpens incident, the near collision of a US and Chinese aircraft, and China's been constructing airstrips in the South China Sea. The Philippines brought a case of arbitration against China. ASEAN still remains notoriously divided over a code of conduct and is making no real progress on this front. So obviously, this is a huge dispute, huge flashpoint, constant topic of discussion here for us at The Diplomat. Anyways, Prashant, I'm going to put you on the spot here. I want you to just run me through your major expectations for China and ASEAN in the South China Sea in 2015. What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, so I think the big question on everybody's minds is whether There's been sort of a debate about whether we could see potentially a change in China's position, maybe a sort of reduction in its assertiveness in the South China Sea. And this is, you know, some people say due to a variety of factors, including China's interpretation that 2015 is going to be a big economic year in terms of ASEAN economic integration, in terms of the conclusion of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, potentially TPP as well. And so the Chinese want to focus primarily on economic issues and not sort of be too assertive in the South China Sea that could undermine their position. You know, I wrote a piece basically saying that we should be kind of cautious about this, because I remember people making similar predictions when the Chinese sort of came up with a new strategy for ASEAN-China relations in the 10th anniversary of their strategic partnership in 2013. And then 7 months later, they basically moved an oil rig into the Vietnamese exclusive economic zone. So I think, you know, we should be very careful when we overinterpret potential changes in Chinese behavior. That being said, though, I definitely think that the Chinese over the last couple of months, after the first half of the year when they've been a little bit more assertive in the South China Sea, they certainly have gone on a sort of renewed charm offensive, particularly in the economic side, with countries in mainland Southeast Asia. And also, interesting to note that the Chinese were very quick and very public about giving assistance recently to Malaysia following the flood situation there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's interesting because Malaysia is the chair for ASEAN this year. And I think, you know, many people are looking to Malaysia with a little bit of ambivalence, wondering if Malaysia as a claimant state is going to be very forward-leaning in terms of trying to push for the conclusion of a code of conduct with China, or whether it's going to continue its current behavior, which is sort of maintaining and making sure that it can safeguard its own claims and sort of a level of ASEAN solidarity, but in no way is it sort of forward-leaning in the way of changing the status quo in the way that the Philippines and Vietnam are in terms of countering China's behavior in the South China Sea. So I think that's going to be another interesting angle to see the ASEAN's perspective on things, because Malaysia, my understanding is Malaysian diplomats and foreign policy officials would be very happy if the South China Sea issue remains calm throughout 2015 and Malaysia is allowed to sort of keep its claims and focus squarely on economic issues and regional integration issues, because I think that's where they want ASEAN to be. And Malaysia sort of sees itself in this year as kind of a way to show that it's, you know, as one of ASEAN's founding members, it can guide and lead ASEAN on some of these economic issues. So anything that would interrupt Malaysia on that would sort of be perceived as not very positive in the eyes of Malaysian leaders.
Mm-hmm. Could you talk a bit about this this arbitration case at The Hague between, you know, the Philippines and China? That's obviously going to be a major story over the course of this year. What are your expectations from both sides? I mean, obviously, you know, Vietnam's now joining in on the fun, if you can call it that. Yeah. What are your expectations? And obviously, you know, Shannon, feel free to jump in here. I know you've been writing about this a bit too.
Yeah, so I mean, the decision is expected, some say by the end of 2015, some say by early 2016. I think regardless of, you know, what the outcome is, I think it's going to be very significant, because it's basically the first case that's being decided on the South China Sea that's filed by a claimant. So regardless of what happens, we're going to have a sort of very interesting analysis both of the legal approach that's being used by the Philippines, and because the Philippines has sort of relied on this sort of some people call lawfare approach, mm-hmm. and the Chinese seem to be sticking with, you know, sort of not ignoring, I would say, but definitely continuing their assertive behavior in the South China Sea in terms of changing certain features, asserting its claims, dredging new features, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very interesting competition between two different approaches. So I definitely think that that's going to be something that people are going to be looking at, not just the Philippines, and as you point out, Vietnam has submitted its own separate, sort of claim to the tribunal, which is separate from the Philippines. They're not explicitly supporting it, but it's also interesting to see how other claimants react to this as well, because this is for Malaysia and for other countries as well that are non-claimants, like Indonesia. This is essentially about what kinds of approaches will prevail in the South China Sea and the benefits of that legal approach. So,
Shannon, Franz, do you agree with Prashant's assessment of the South China Sea? Do you guys have different expectations, similar expectations? Anything you'd like to add about China?
I think one thing that's interesting to think about is how much of Beijing, so-called assertive behavior is actually being driven by the Philippines arbitration case. Even though, as Prashant noted, Beijing is trying to say, we're ignoring it, the court doesn't have the jurisdiction to rule on this, this case is meaningless. You can tell that they're a little nervous, and I think the best sign of that is that they really stepped up their land reclamation activities right as the Philippines was submitting their arbitration. And the theory is that China is worried that its nine-dashed line claim is going to be declared overly broad, and it will have to rely on the land-based method of determining sovereignty, which is that you can't just circle a part of the ocean and say, this is mine. You have to say, I own this island, therefore I get, the 12 nautical miles of territory, and if it's big enough, the 200 nautical miles of exclusive economic zone. And a lot of the marine features that are being argued over here are barely above water. Some of them are actually never above water, even at low tide. So the theory is that China is trying to essentially change the facts on their ground. They're trying to create islands as fast as they can so that if the nine-dash line is ruled against them, they still have chunks of territory that they can claim by saying, well, look, now there's this new island, and because it's big enough, we can now claim the maritime territory and get close to something approximating the nine-dash line, even if they can't get the nine-dash line itself upheld by the court. So it's an interesting way of looking at it. It shows that Beijing might be taking this arbitration a bit more seriously than it says. So it'll be very interesting to see how the court actually ends up ruling.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And we'll come back to Southeast Asia, because I do want to talk a bit about some of the important political players. Notably, we haven't really mentioned Indonesia. I want to talk a bit about Jokowi and his views on foreign policy and our expectations for him. But let's just take a step back and just talk about a few domestic issues in China. Namely, I just want to talk about two things. First is I want to talk about the Chinese economy, which kind of had a mixed year but managed to hit its targets anyways. And I also want to talk about Xi Jinping's anti-corruption campaign, which is a major feature of Chinese domestic politics. So let's actually start with the anti-corruption campaign. And Shannon, this one's mostly for you. I'm very interested to hear your thoughts on, are we going to see a, obviously 2014 was a pretty good year for the anti-corruption campaign. Zhou Yongkang, other members of the Chinese military elite and political elite fell. Even towards the end of the year, a senior Chinese diplomat, a bureaucrat from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs even, was caught up in this. And obviously there have been numerous flies. Tigers and flies obviously has been the metaphor used by the Chinese government to describe its intentions. So do you think, going forward into 2015 that this campaign will only intensify? Are we going to see a similar tiger on the level of Zhou Yongkang fall?
There's been indications that we should expect another tiger to come down. When they announced Zhou Yongkang was being prosecuted, there were some cryptic hints to other clues that were discovered in the course of that investigation. Whether that means his underlings or someone at the same level as Zhou Yongkang that could potentially be subject to investigation is open for debate. One really interesting thing is that the Chinese media has begun openly talking about the existence of factions within the party, which political observers have always known that there are these political factions, but the Chinese Communist Party really valued at least the illusion of unity. And refused to acknowledge the existence of factionalism in sort of party infighting. And with this anti-corruption campaign, they've actually started naming factions within the party. You had Ning Jihua, who was a top advisor for former President Hu Jintao. He was recently placed under investigation after about 2 years of serious behind-the-scenes party investigation. He's been formally announced that he's dismissed from the party. And they, you know, named him as the head of this Shanxi gang. There's the, you know, secretary gang. So there's indications that Xi Jinping is more serious about this, and he's really, you know, he's trying to defend the ultimate image of the Communist Party as a, you know, non-corrupt institution. And in doing that, he's willing to sacrifice some other parts of the image. He's willing to cross lines that other people hadn't been willing to cross in terms of admitting that there are problems right now. And another thing to keep an eye on, of course, is that all the people who were formally, you know, arrested and placed under prosecution in 2014 are probably going to go to trial in 2015. So General Xu Caiho, Zhou Yongkang, potentially Ling Jihua, if the process moves fast enough. So when we saw the Bo Xilai trial, the government just dumped all of these salacious details about his personal life, his business dealings. It was really kind of a soap opera type story. I don't know if they're going to take that same approach in 2015. There's a huge emphasis on the rule of law in China right now, obviously, but I do think they're going to try to increase the transparency, and that might mean letting out additional details, and those additional details could in turn start to implicate other higher ups in the Chinese Communist Party. So I definitely don't think we've seen the last of tigers being taken down.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think I agree with that too. It's interesting you mentioned the factionalism issue too, because you know there's been a lot of conversation about you know, Hu Jintao has essentially just disappeared from the Chinese political scene. And it remains to be seen if his associates are going to be part of this anti-corruption campaign, which would, you know, I think that'd be really interesting to see that kind of, you know, one generation of Chinese leadership effectively, you know, if not attacking, but targeting the previous one under this sort of anti-corruption purge, if you can call it that. I actually just, you know, noticed at the time, so maybe let's save the discussion of the Chinese economy for another day, because that's a big one. Let's just go back to Southeast Asia, though. And Prashant, this one is, again, a question for you. You know, Jokowi is someone I'm trying to figure out, because when it comes to foreign policy, he's obviously somewhat of a unknown quantity. I mean, recently Indonesia ended 2014 on kind of a strange note with its decision to, you know, enforce its claims to its water nearby against against illegal fishing, which, you know, Jokowi was essentially criticized as being a bit of a hot-headed leader for his actions there. What can we expect out of him in and Indonesia in general in 2015, both, you know, as a unitary actor and as a leader within ASEAN?
Yeah, so I think that, I mean, 2015 in many ways is probably going to be the year of judgment for Jokowi and his reform agenda. And I think, you know, a lot of 2014 was euphoria around his election, the campaign, and then subsequently his inauguration and some of the rolling out of his initiatives and new ideas, like this sort of global maritime nexus that he's been talking about for Indonesia. Some of these maritime connectivity initiatives. But as you point out, you know, a lot of the difficult issues were coming to the fore at the end of the year, and they're probably going to, they are, actually already are rolling into the new year. I mean, I think yesterday, the day before, Indonesia sunk Malaysian vessels that were, you know, sort of, they were incursions into Indonesian waters, and the Indonesians have done that with other countries as well. And now they've expanded that to Malaysia. So this raises, you know, a number of difficult issues, because Jokowi and, you know, his foreign minister, they've laid out a set of priorities for Indonesian foreign policy in 2015, and a lot of them seem very domestic oriented. So things like, you know, preserving Indonesia's territorial integrity, protecting domestic workers, economic diplomacy. But I think a lot of the regional reaction is, you know, when we're looking at a year for the formation of the ASEAN economic community, and Indonesia is seen as a leader within ASEAN, there's a little bit of a disconnect between the leadership hopes for Indonesia and its domestic focus inwards. So I think that tension is going to play out in 2015. And I think when the Indonesian foreign minister, Retno Marsudi, laid out her foreign policy vision, she sort of said, no, you know, we're not really domestic focused. We're still paying attention to the world and the region. But my suspicion is we're going to see a lot of these tensions play out and resolve themselves throughout the rest of the year, because when you're talking about regional consciousness and forming a regional community, and you have, you know, the biggest country in Southeast Asia that accounts for about, you know, 50% of its GDP, sinking vessels from several neighboring states, I mean, you have to ask questions about what that means for this vision of a community. So,
absolutely. And very quickly, Prashant, I just wanted to ask you about Thailand. You know, there was a coup last year in late May, and obviously things have stabilized a bit in the sense that Thailand now is a functioning government with a, you know, the general who led the coup, Prayuth Chan-o-cha, is now the prime minister, and obviously the previous government, Yingluck Shinawatra, is currently undergoing legal action for you know, this rice subsidy scheme and all that. What are your expectations? What can we expect out of Thailand over 2015 again?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, Thailand, you know, the way in which the generals have responded to the idea that there might be an outbreak of new political tensions, which is sort of what the world is worried about with this impeachment proceedings going on against a former prime minister, is sort of, you know, Thailand is still under martial law. So, you know, we're very comfortable with this idea that we can handle any of these protests. But the interesting thing to watch for, the elections the generals announced were supposed to be initially at the end of 2015, but they've now said it's going to be postponed till 2016, and then now people are saying it might even be pushed back to 2017. So the issue really is, as the generals kind of push back these elections and try to consolidate their power and authority, is the Thai public or segments of the Thai public, are they going to grow tired of this idea of Thailand under military rule? And are there going to be an outbreak of new tensions? And that's actually what a lot of people are talking about. And the second issue, which is kind of it's always the unpredictable sort of trend, is whether we're going to eventually see a transition in terms of the monarchy in Thailand. And that just, you know, that's a whole another issue. And, you know, the idea is some people are arguing that the reason why the military is delaying the elections in Thailand to 2016, potentially 2017, is because they think that there is an impending political transition in terms of the royalty. So if that happens in 2015, you know, all bets are off because, you know, there's various factions in Thailand, and this is a very divisive issue, obviously.
Absolutely. All right. So just, you know, with these last few minutes of the podcast, we're going to move over and actually deal with a huge region, South Asia. Obviously, you know, we would again need a lot of time to discuss many of the events that are affecting this region. Obviously, we just heard just this morning the election results out of Sri Lanka, major upset. Mahinda Rajapaksa is out. And the new leader, Sirisena, is, you know, a bit of an unknown quantity again in Sri Lanka, but I think that's going to have important implications for how India and China in particular carry forward their competition, if you can call it, I'll call it that, in the Indian Ocean. But first, I actually want to talk about Afghanistan a bit, because, you know, 2014 and 2015 is obviously, you know, 2014 was a major deadline for Afghanistan. The end of the year marked the end of the official NATO and U.S. military campaign in the country, which is officially over, but, you know, there are some 10,000 U.S. troops staying on under the terms of the bilateral security agreement. Afghanistan obviously underwent a historic election, resulting in an experimental national unity government where power is being shared between the two main presidential rival contenders, which has led to a really strange state of affairs where the country is, you know, 100 days into its new government and it still doesn't have a cabinet. So that raises a bunch of questions about, you know, governance in Afghanistan going forward into 2015. How will this government handle the manifold economic and social problems of the country, you know, not to mention the reconciliation process with the Taliban, which is not going well, to put it mildly. And Efrans, I know you wanted to talk about this, so I'm going to put you on the spot here. You know, watching Afghanistan's political transition in 2014 from the Karzai government to this new untested, unknown, experimental government, what are your expectations and worries for 2015?
Well, let me maybe perhaps just focus on the military situation for now. And I think we all know that the more ambitious goal of pacifying the entire country of Afghanistan is now passé. I think the principal objective behind the training mission, the NATO training mission, Resolute Support, is to have Afghan forces reach a maturity level where they are able to control about 80% of the population, and where insurgent groups are not going to be able to dislocate them from key geographical positions. I think this will be entirely feasible up until 2017. Why do I say 2017? It's because up until then, money, the international support through donors, through NATO, is secured. What maybe I can add a little caveat here, and that is that, in my opinion, from what I've seen, is that we need an adequate unclassified post-2014 campaign plan for Afghanistan, which sort of links Afghan National Army, well, actually Afghan National Security Forces resources to objectives, and further linking that to the gradual withdrawal of all the military advisors from Afghanistan. And that's, I say that just because I think it will be important for the future of Afghanistan to garner necessary political support from donor countries. So just to sum up the military situation, I think that it will be highly unlikely that military progress in the field before 2017 will be undone unless we substantially, or the Afghan government has to substantially cut the national defense budget below 2.7 billion, which I believe is the current annual operations cost of the Afghan National Army and the Afghan National Uniform Police, which are the two most important forces in the country when it comes to fighting the Taliban. As for the political situation, it's hard for me to predict, but what I said previously, of course, about battlefield progress in Afghanistan up until 2017, can be undone in a matter of months or weeks if the political situation is not resolved in the next couple of months, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And maybe, you know, this should be the topic of a more detailed podcast that we can, devote a discussion of, devote an entire podcast to a discussion of Afghanistan, because I think there's a lot of interesting things to talk about there. Another thing that I would just add on the military angle that I'm particularly curious about is to see how Ashraf Ghani's government interacts with both India and China. I think he sent some very interesting signals about being a proactive diplomat when it comes to these countries, and both India and China have obviously been waiting for 2015 as that sort of symbolic milestone of the time when, you know, U.S. NATO support essentially begins to slide down, and India and China can make some important inroads. Obviously, for India, the perennial question in Afghanistan is how India's moves in Afghanistan will affect its relationship with Pakistan. But that's maybe something I can talk about very briefly, since I do write about South Asia quite a bit for The Diplomat. My expectations for 2015, after Narendra Modi and the BJP were elected in May last year, I think we saw the slightest glimmers of hope for a reconciliation process between India and Pakistan, just based on the relationship between the two leaders, actually, Nawaz Sharif and Narendra Modi. But obviously, all of that was undone. And I actually have very low expectations for the year as far as India and Pakistan goes. I think it's going to be like 2013, actually, to put it to put it in frank terms. I think we're going to see continued ceasefire violations, no real diplomatic progress. I think the Modi government has little to gain in terms of domestic political capital by making rapprochements towards Pakistan. I think a lot of its own political base is very hostile towards Pakistan. And obviously with the progress that the BJP has made in Kashmir and across the country, I think it's in a very strong position domestically. I think to go back to something that Prashant actually said about Jokowi, I think this is a very similar year for Narendra Modi, actually. Because last year, again, was colored with the Modi wave, the Modi euphoria. You know, everybody was very excited to see this tea seller rise to the highest ranks of Indian politics. This was a man who, he has no real issues with corruption, which is a major problem in Indian governments. Obviously, he does have his, you know, tainted past with the Gujarat riots of 2002 and the Hindu nationalism and communal violence stuff that's obviously concerning both to his critics and his supporters, frankly. So I think, you know, 2015 will be a major test for Modi, both economically, because he hasn't really delivered. I mean, I was honestly surprised at how dynamic Modi was in the international scene. I never expected him to really take to international diplomacy the way he has. He's made some fantastic progress with Japan, with the United States, with the BRICS countries. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how he can kind of bring it back and deliver, you know, his promise of good governance and economic growth to India in 2015. Does anybody want to add anything about Modi or India? Okay, that's completely fine. This podcast is starting to run a little long, so we'll try to wrap up. But very briefly, I did promise. I think it was Prashant. We said that we would talk about the Sri Lankan election result a bit. Now, can I just ask you, you know, for your take on this election result? I mean, what are the expectations here, both from you know, just for Sri Lanka as a country and for its relationship with both India and China, possibly in other countries?
Yeah, I think, you know, Ankit, as you wrote in your piece, I think the first thing to say about the election is that it's actually very surprising that the outcome went as smoothly as it did, in the sense that Rajapaksa conceded and the election results have sort of been allowed to play themselves out, so to speak. I think in terms of the transition, in terms of Sri Lanka's foreign policy more broadly, I do think the interesting point that I would make is that you might see, and I think as you argued in the piece as well, a sort of more evening out of Sri Lanka's posture. So in Rajapaksa's case, you had basically the United States pressuring him on human rights issues, particularly after the conclusion of the civil war, and then him moving a little bit closer to China. And I think now with the new leadership, I think what you may have is a little bit of a more even out approach, which gives the United States a little bit of an opening in terms of addressing human rights concerns and giving a little bit more influence in their inter-Sri Lanka, where it was a little bit more difficult for it to do so previously. And I think that the relationship with India, the interesting angle there is the Tamil angle, obviously. Where, you know, Rajapaksa, because of, you know, what he did, the conclusion of the war, and also how he conducted his government in terms of the Tamil Tigers initially, you know, there was obviously this very problematic Tamil angle with the southern part of India and the Indian government in general. But now, with the removal of that problem, potentially, you may have, you know, I'm not going to say very smooth relations between New Delhi and Colombo, but at least there's an opening for a fresh start on this very narrow issue. What I think remains to be seen for domestic politics in Sri Lanka is whether the new leadership will actually make changes for minorities in Sri Lanka, particularly the Tamils, right? So there's no guarantee that this is the case because, you know, my understanding of the political situation in Sri Lanka is that, you know, I don't think that there is a lot of appetite for the, you know, major concessions for Tamils just because Rajapaksa was voted out, because I think there were a number of other issues that were dogging his record, including his authoritarian tendencies and corruption, et cetera, et cetera. So that's going to be interesting to see going forward.
Yeah, and you know what you said right there about the minorities at the end was my assessment as well. I don't think it's a given that we're going to see any sort of major changes there in Sri Lanka. Anyways, I think that puts us at about an hour on this podcast. Like I said, we were a little bit delayed with the podcast towards the end of 2014, so hopefully we can make it up to our listeners by having this extra long session to start off the year. Thanks a lot for your time and for your insight, all three of you. It's really great to, you know, kind of do this overview of Asia. Obviously, we left out a lot of things, you know, just some issues off the top of my head. Iran, we obviously have the nuclear issue. We have Central Asia. We have Myanmar, which has its own elections coming up. And, you know, Mongolia, Russia, again, we didn't really talk about the U.S. pivot to Asia, the TPP. we touched on. But, you know, that's, again, the great thing about what we get to do with The Diplomat is we get to cover those issues as the year go on. So as the year goes on. So I hope everybody listening to this podcast just keeps following us over the year. And we'll obviously be covering all of these issues over the course of 2015. Thanks a lot for joining me, guys.
Always a pleasure.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And keep an eye out for Franz and Prashant, our latest additions. They're going to be all over the site, and they've already been producing a lot of great writing. So I'm personally looking forward to this next year. Thanks a lot, guys. And we'll be back hopefully next week with another podcast. Thank you.